E2. Number 4A.
I have to make a correction. Apparently, when speaking about John Dolly's Matrix, I made at one point used the wrong word. I said that he was the only one that made a matrix deductively. And at one point, I repeated it and said inductively. So it must be deductively. So please correct that in your notes. But I'm so glad that you all noticed it, that I was saying something wrong. Sign that you got it. All right, then I was just saying how we proceed when we build up a matrix in the inductive way, where one goes out from the phenomena back to the principle of it, so that one goes out from a hypothesis, then like, there are 6 in prophets, and that's a hypothesis that they may be built into a matrix. In order to prove that, one takes the individual prophet, studies the text, tries to see if one finds an epitome of the meaning of the prophet. Then one would write down one after the other one's finding in a list of 16 findings. Then you would have to go and say, now, have those 16 somewhere, or some of them, a common denominator. If you find some of them that have a common denominator, you put them into one category, and so split up the 16 into categories, no matter what the categories are, which you have found, so that the 16 already are split up perhaps in a few categories, then still you wouldn't have a matrix. Then you would have to see if there is a common characteristic running through those categories horizontally, and that's very difficult again. And only in this way, little by little, you would build in the boxes in a matrix. We'll do that afterwards. I just tell you the theory of it. Build in little by little until finally you could say either to yourself, yes, it is a matrix, or it isn't. In a science, you always have to go out from a hypothesis and try to work from there and be very willing to find out that the hypothesis was wrong. And then you know it is wrong, and then you leave it. So you can see that the inductive method is a very difficult method, an extremely difficult method. And why is it difficult? First, because it starts with a hypothesis, which you don't know if it's true. And second, which is the most important part and most difficult, is to know the right interpretation of a text, so as to arrive really at that epitome, which is really the main epitome of a text. And this needs something more than just reading, and it needs more than inspiration. It needs a thorough knowledge of the principle of text interpretation, something which will take us a whole week next week to do, to introduce that there are objective principles for interpreting a text, because as long as the text is only interpreted inspirationally, then we will not find a true matrix. All what we will find is a chart or some kind of tabulation, but not a true matrix. So you can see, in order to have a working method, we need, so to say, 4 things that correlate. Namely, first, that the subject has structure and is investigated structurally. Second, it needs a knowledge of the principle of interpretation, because interpretation is not just reading facts, it's actually reading structure. that principle of interpretation is all about relationship and structural relationship. And third, it needs the ability to represent structure, which one has touched through interpretation in the form and the method of matrix. So structure, interpretation, matrix are all correlated and are three different methods and three different aspects, really, of the same thing. So in order to be able to investigate the infinite one in its structural sense, we have to be a master of all those three aspects. Structuralism, we have to know what structural is and structuralism is. We have to know the principle of interpretation, and we have to know what are the factors and the elements that are necessary in order that the matrix is a matrix, and so that we don't confuse it and mistake it for just a chart. Now with this, I've said more or less everything. You may have wondered why up to now only John Dolley gave a deductive matrix, and all his students all worked only on the inductive way. Well, in order to build a matrix in a deductive way, it needs an enormous amount of spiritual sense combined with scientific sense. Spiritual sense alone is not enough. You couldn't do it with spiritual sense alone. It needs that wonderful combination which John Dolley had, that he had not only spiritual sense, but that he had an enormous amount of scientific sense. I would say he had more scientific sense than what he was aware of, and that only the later years have been bringing to the front really the magnitude of his scientific approach, which he wasn't even quite aware of what he was doing. So why is it so difficult to build up a matrix deductively? Because you would have a very, very fine and refined and delicate sense of the shades and hues of our system of reference. What we are therefore actually doing and have been doing over the last 20 years is to culture that sense, that finer sense of the capitalized terms and our system of reference through the back door, namely through induction. And this is what we will do this week, and see how you have within you already a very fine sense and very delicate sense of those capitalized terms, the moment I can just introduce categories. And then you will find that you sense it yourself, those finer differentiation that exists, say, within the category of the word or within the category of a Christ or Christianity. So that you will feel towards the end of this week that actually you have a much more cultured sense of these capitalized terms than you are aware of, because just one thing is still perhaps missing, and that is to categorize it properly. So you will get quite a thrill towards the end of the week to see how much structured consciousness and spiritual consciousness each one has in himself quite naturally. It only needs to be brought out from him and awakened in him. I don't have to put it over. The system itself, the categories themselves, will reveal it. I don't have to reveal it. I just have to ask the right questions. And the right question will be very simple, that there's a question which you can ask, namely, what is in the matrix the A, and what is the I, and what is the J? Is the A consistent? We have said the A and the J must have a consistent characteristic. I just ask, is it consistent? And if you feel it is consistent, everything falls into place. All right. So I start with our subject, the infinite being. We all are here because we are interested in knowing the infinite one. And we all are here because we don't want to have a mystical sense of the infinite one, but the scientific sense of it, which means that we don't want to take the infinite one just as a amorphous big whole, as an undifferentiated whole, and take it in a sentimental way, in an inspirational way, but that we would like to understand that infinite one. And in order to understand the infinite one, we agree that the infinite one is understandable through its science, and that science demands system. System demands that there are categories and laws, that there are relationships between the categories. It demands that, therefore, we will have to tackle that whole question from the point of view of a divine system of reference. We think that the Bible and the textbook give a science of this infinite one. Now, Mrs. Eddy says that it is science. But just because somebody says it is science, it doesn't need to be science. This is not authority enough that somebody says something is science. Something is science when we can see it in its science. When we see, so to say, the coherency of the subject, the coherency of the parts within the whole, and only then we are convinced that it is a science. Therefore, if we take the Bible and the textbook right from the beginning as being a presentation of the science of being, then this is for us at the beginning just a hypothesis. We can't take it because Mrs. Eddy says so. Mrs. Eddy must say so because it is so. So in order to be convinced that it is so, we go out from the hypotheses, and we have to be well aware what kind of hypotheses we work on, and that we don't take that as a given fact. We work on the hypotheses that, say, the textbook presents the whole of being, and not only a part of being. That would have been one of the hypotheses, that we would have to find out through the consistency of her presentation that actually all fundamental problems are dealt with in that textbook, and that there are not parts that are left out. But before we don't understand that, it is a hypothesis that the textbook gives the science of the whole of being. Another hypothesis is that we trust the textbook as being a presentation of that science of being. It may not be so. So if we trust it, it's only a hypothesis at the beginning and not an actual understanding of it. And further, if we take the textbook as the science of being, we work from another hypothesis, namely that it contains actually a system and a science, that therefore the textbook is written according to categorical laws, according to relational laws, according to structural laws. But at the beginning, this is a hypothesis. And only through our work we should find out if that hypothesis is right or wrong. If we find out that it is right, then, only then, we know. And up to that point, we do not know, we only believe. And I don't think that any movement can live for a long time on the basis of believing in the doctrine. It has to be understood. Now this, so I have pointed out the hypothesis from which we work. You know, you always take a hypothesis and say, all right, I take that hypothesis as if it were true, but you always leave somehow in your consciousness a little door open which says, I'm willing to correct it. Therefore, if we work from that hypothesis, we would have to see within the textbook or the Bible, we would have to see the divine system of reference. And we would have to find that divine system of reference, which, as we have been showing in other classes, that actually Mrs. Eddy uses such a divine system of reference, those three great categories of capitalized terms. Further, we built on the hypothesis that the textbook has structure and is written structurally, and actually through induction we did find out that the textbook is written structurally, and that the method of representing it is a matrix. And so finally we arrived at the proof that the textbook does represent the whole of being and not just one aspect of the whole of being, that actually the textbook is a trustworthy revelation, because third, we have found out that the 16 chapters of the textbook make a matrix. Now, what kind of matrices can we find in that big subject of the Infinite One, especially when we investigate the textbook? And there we can see that because the textbook has structure, it can be represented either as a overall matrix, namely the matrix of the textbook itself, or if we take other aspects that the textbook lends itself for finding a whole number of matrices. That, for instance, the textbook lends itself for finding the matrix of mind, of the synonymous term mind, that it lends itself of finding a matrix of the synonymous term spirit and soul and principle and life and truth and love. In other words, you can see that the matrix, that the textbook is not just showing one matrix, but that it lends itself to be investigated in many matrices. Now the question only is that we should ask ourselves, because this matrix work takes a lot of time, of study, of investigation, of quiet pondering and weighing the values and weighing the text. It is not something that one just can do one nice evening. It is usually a job that takes months and years, many years. So that one should ask oneself now, what are the most important matrices that we should investigate? And so I would say that the primary matrices of primary value would be those matrices which have to do with the capitalized terms, because the capitalized terms are the overall general aspects of being. But that does not exclude that we could also use the textbook for other matrices. You could make a matrix of the term law, for instance. You could make a matrix on the term idea or understanding. Even of a negative one, a very interesting one, is to investigate the question of evil and build up a whole matrix on the question of evil and to see how the question of evil is not just answered with an atomistic definition and answer, just saying evil is that and that and that, but that actually a matrix gives a 16-fold answer, and that only taking in 16 answers within one matrix is really giving the answer to the problem of evil. You see at once something new, other and something new about matrix work is that matrix gives another answer to any question than the classical way of answering a question. The classical way was asking, what do you mean by the term evil? What is evil? And the classical answer is to give one definition. Now, this is no more possible. One has found out that giving a definition is no more sufficient for any answer. That the answer must be given at least matrix-wise. That it is, that the answer has so many strata, so many levels, so many aspects, that all those fundamental aspects can actually only be given through the answer of a matrix and no more of a definition. That's why Mrs. Eddy never gives definitions in her textbook. She never defines mind as a whole of mind. She never defines spirit. Why didn't she just say, I use the term mind, and with mind I mean this and this and this. Now you have it. She never gives the definition of Christ. She gives a few dozen definitions. No, a few dozen answers. And each answer is different. But if you can see the answer as a matrix, then you get the full answer. So matrix is a new way of answering a question and is a higher way than the way of definition. Why should we investigate the infinite one as matrix? We have seen just from those first two ones we have made with that shopping business and the workshop that the matrix is a method of creativity, that a matrix is so intelligent that it gives us new information, that through matrix method we can grow in understanding. And this we will see also during this week, that the moment we take any of our big subjects in Christian Science in a matrix way, that the matrix itself begins to teach us, and to teach us many, many, many practical things. That the matrix teaches us how to practice, how to give treatment, how to tackle problems, how to tackle problems wrongly and rightly, how to sight past the pitfalls of a wrong treatment. All that can be drawn out from that finer method called matrix. In order to lead thought gently into the matrix consciousness of the science of being, I feel that the easiest way is to go through the historical and chronological development of the idea in Christian Science as it unfolded to Mr. Dawley and to us in a chronological way, and that by just going over that chronology, we may perhaps be able to see what it means. So, from now on, I will speak about the history of the development of matrix. Now, the history of the development of matrix started at a point when nobody was thinking about matrix, nobody knew what the matrix is, and nobody really knew that we were actually already thinking very near to a matrix without knowing it. How did it start? You see, it started somehow in a similar way as we started yesterday with a checklist, only naturally transposed into the metaphysical realm. Namely, it was the time around about 1938 when Mr. Dorley with a group began to investigate the seven synonymous terms. Investigating the seven synonymous terms, we were making a list of all the ideas characterizing each of the seven synonymous terms. And by contemplating those lists of each synonymous term, we would get little by little, so to say, the tone of that synonymous term, the tonality of that synonymous term, and we felt very happy about our findings. When we had studied that by going through the textbook and considering every statement where the synonymous term appeared in the text and finding that list, we began to investigate one or two of the chapters of Science and Health. I remember that one of the first one was prayer and the first part of the Science of Being, when in 38 John Dorley would then show that with our knowledge of the seven synonymous terms, the tonality of those seven synonymous terms, he could read, say, the chapter on prayer and find that the chapter on prayer would be built up in the order of the word, so that the chapter on prayer would first give us the prayer of mind, then the prayer of spirit, then the prayer of soul, and then the prayer of principle and life and truth and love, and that would cover those pages of that chapter. So one began to see that even without that, the synonymous terms would have to be mentioned within that order in the text, that the tone of those seven synonymous terms would run through the text in an ordered way. So we had, so to say, a ordered list of those seven synonymous terms. And then came the big point. Then, when considering, for instance, that first prayer, the prayer of mind, which is the prayer of true desire or to know God as He is, one could ask oneself, well, why doesn't Mrs. Eddy state that just in one sentence or in one paragraph? Why to write 2 pages about it?